Right, the lesson. The focus on the short term and comparisons between government rather than on how to achieve a long term New Zealand Inc. goal and sticking to it seems to be a critical roadblock in climate change discussions. See what's happening across the Tasman, what's happened here. We don't effectively have what we would call a broad electoral support for a climate change policy in New Zealand. We put a lot of attention into trying to get it right, whether it's a tax, whether it's an ETS. It doesn't really matter, let's get started. They're not that different in their effect. They can be changed as time goes on. We need a range of instruments that are likely to be more effective, for example, the ETS and regulatory measures to get action locked in. And I don't think we need to get it perfect. It doesn't have to be right. They can overlap. We can continue to tweak it as time goes on. The absence of independent peer review of policy to give, would be something that would give confidence and integrity to the decision process. And I think that is a lesson over the last 20 years. And lastly, the economic analysis to date has been based largely on these fixed time horizons, which aren't commensurate with increasing stringency of future emission targets. And so this is something that does need quite serious attention and investment. So what would a framework for enduring policy include? We have a mutual accountability process that drives our international discussion around climate change and the negotiations. So what about that in the domestic context? Some may say we already have it. We have all sectors, we have all gases in the ETS. But is that really what we have? I don't think so. It's a name only. The policy shifts the responsibility from major polluters to taxpayers for a very long time in the current legislation. And as I said before, review is difficult because of entitlements, seen as entitlements to polluters. Gives an opportunity to relitigate effectively. The ETS incentive is extremely weak, and so the result will be little effect on New Zealand emissions and policy unlikely to endure. Now, this creates a continuation of uncertainty and certainly not an effective transition to a low carbon economy. So, what can we do now? This first point is really, in effect, the crux of it, and probably the most difficult. I mean, I'm not saying any of this is easy. There needs to be some stable political agreement on climate change. First of all, to find where those points of agreement are across particularly the major parties, rather than having to rely on small parties to prop up an unpalatable policy. Possibly to help with that, an independent peer review system for policy based on an agreed set of driving principles and some predetermined trigger points for ramping up the policy. Now, some countries have looked at adaptive policy approaches, and there is a literature around this, interestingly enough. And by adaptive policy approach, we mean ramping up policy in small steps, monitoring it and tweaking it. Now, one could suggest perhaps the independent peer review system could play a role in developing those guiding principles and assisting in identifying where those trigger points might be for ramping up the policy over time. Now, some would say that might be more uncertain, but it would seem that if we did it from a stable base and then moved ourselves upwards, this could produce some useful outcomes. I'm reminded of the work that was done in the Netherlands when I was there in the 1990s on their air pollution and water pollution agreements, which had a very similar policy approach where they identified standards that had to be met and an expectation that they would be changed, and they were, and they continued to ramp up their water quality standards to a level where well, I haven't been there recently. I expect that you don't go outside your door and smell the pollution, which was the case in the 1990s. So that has actually been very effective in managing an environmental policy process. I think also that the greater weight needs to be given to demonstrating what can be done to reduce emissions and framed in a way that will elicit low carbon behaviour. And that goes back to the research around framing. Very important to understand that and to help use that to help us develop ways in which we can demonstrate what can be done. And importantly, to ensure connections are made across sectors to avoid unintended consequences when policy actions are applied. So we need, in this process, also to undertake dynamic economic assessments, as I've indicated. We need an interdisciplinary research around social and behaviour analysis, and we need to develop new and stable institutional arrangements. Quite a challenge in our style of government. Do big departments do it better than small departments? Do project groups do it better than large departments? How do we marry the State Sector Act requirement on chief executives to be responsible for their particular bit? How do we break down those silos? Do we have the right state sector structure to enable us to deal with issues like climate change, which are intergenerational, long-term, uncertain, dynamic, all those things? Not many issues quite like that. I would posit that it's harder than tax. And Bob Buckle was saying this morning that the tax review is something where we need to get cross-party, cross-electoral support for. Well, good enough for tax has to be done for climate change. We will not achieve anything otherwise. And part of all this is our improved public communications with effective framing of the issues. And I would suggest that the way in which we do this has to be done as a combined effort, and I would like to say at this point that I think some of the initiatives in this area, like the Science Media Centre and a number of other activities that are going across New Zealand, are contributing towards getting a better informed public around these issues. But we have a ways to go, and these are just some issues on the table for further discussion. So I'll leave it there, Jonathan, and we can have a bit more discussion with you.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, there are a lot of people here with experience in the room, and we've lived through much of the last few decades of shambolic policy making. Judy, so who would like to comment first? Yes, at the back.
I'm Margaret Gordon, Judy. I've just been trying to think about a submission to raise in 2040, and it occurs to me that I was interested in what you said about local government, because I think they have a very important role to play. But it's a bit difficult to know who's got the purse strings for what, but they are the people that we most interact with about the way we live, and therefore are part of what our spending is and how policies are implemented and how they can help. And I really think we need a kind of a local body think tank, not just one for Greater Auckland, but somebody or some group to help connect all the councils to the government so that they can plan uniformity and policy on things that really matter here.
Yes, I'm aware that the Local Government New Zealand Association are very active with a small climate change group, both at political level and at officer level, who are working through some of those issues. Of course, they have to be reflected back in their own instruments that they use for managing climate change. And some of them are doing that. Waikato, for example, has energy as one of its priority topics in its review of its regional plan, and are doing that currently. And that's an indirect way of addressing some of the issues around climate change.
A couple of points, but on that last point, of course, the Ministry of the Environment at one stage, well, for some years, was funding the International Initiative for Local Environment Initiative, or whatever it was called. But the Ministry of the Environment terminated that, and they were working specifically with local government to help them with both mitigation and adaptation. But the current government terminated that money, so it's all been dismantled. I think two other points, though, Judy. One is that it might be worth including in your policy history a removal from the Resource Management Act of the provisions, or the inclusion and then removal of the provisions for considering greenhouse gas emissions under the Resource Management Act. And that was justified at the time, badly I thought, but justified on the grounds that we would have a carbon tax. The carbon tax never eventuated, but the prohibition on considering greenhouse gas matters has remained in the Resource Management Act, which significantly limits local government and central government's ability to take that into account under all of the Resource Management Act planning matters. And secondly, I think we should be talking explicitly about the distributional aspect of the ETS and the enormous rot and ripping off of the public of New Zealand and the small to medium enterprises, while the big companies get their pollution subsidised. And, you know, just the other day when we were listening to the minister, he was really refusing to engage with that issue and going on about how we have now will have a price on carbon, but refusing to admit that a price on carbon will not influence behaviour if that price doesn't land on the producers themselves. And of course that's precisely what ETS does, is to cost ship those costs to the rest of us. And I think we should have a public discussion about that question of the big ripple, essentially, on behalf of the producers.
Okay, can I just comment on the Resource Management Act? There is provision in the Resource Management Act for the effects of climate change to be considered.
Oh, yes, but not this.
And, yeah, that's correct. But also, if you read it really carefully, there is also a provision which enables renewable energy to be promoted. But of course, yes, you're right, the I'm not sure when it was actually in there, then removed. But I know I attempted to get it in there a long, long time ago, back in the 80s, and it was not thought to be appropriate at that time, but for other reasons, actually, rather than the carbon tax. But however, I think it goes back to the point I made, is that I think we need a comprehensive climate change policy, which does have all those elements in it and does recognise the role that local government plays in its transport planning, in its energy, in the energy planning, in the areas of urban design, etc., that can have an effect on reducing our burden on fossil fuels. So, however, I think you're right, it does need to be explicit. With respect to the last point, I mean, Jonathan might like to take this up in another forum and have a discussion about this, but yes, I would agree, and I think the only optimism is around it that it's not going to endure, Kat.
No.
It won't endure. So that's why I'm not losing sleep over it, personally.
So, it's set up plain so that not only will these people be able to cost it, but they'll also then ask for compensation for these changes, which is the point you made.
I just want to, just following up Kat's point, if you could offer any reflections at all on one of the fundamental problems that the distributional question poses, namely how we deal with this problem of an asymmetry in power in a political system on an issue like climate change, where you have a concentrated interest with considerable resources, i.e. the fossil fuel industry, in New Zealand's case, agricultural sector and so on, set against diffuse interests of taxpayers and citizens. And that asymmetry, as we've seen it play out here in New Zealand and in Australia at the moment and in the United States, is such that it generates highly disadvantageous outcomes from the point of view, anyway, of the environment, taxpayers and citizens.
Name and shame is one approach. walking the talk. I mean, there's a whole lot of disparate things that one can do. I think transparency is what is at the heart of this. I think that if we had a mechanism and an institution that was independent, or some, when I say institution, I mean an arrangement. Doesn't have to be a building or an organisation, but it could be an arrangement of people who are respected and so forth, that are not part of that inner cabal. I think we would have a chance of having a transparent conversation. I think that we have the vestiges of it through the Parliamentary Commission of the Environment. I personally think we need something different for climate change. I think we need something stronger. We need a recognition that we do need to deal with those distributional issues. But there are some ways of getting them on the table, which are in the name and shame category, and I think all of us have no ways of doing that, which can start the process of having that conversation, and then having something that is removed from the political process to provide some overview or input into the policy process. I think we need to redesign the way we do policy too. I think there's a whole lot of things that are required to get a package that will move away from that process. But I would suggest that direct naming and you know, all of us have our views as to who wrote the ETS bill, and there were a number of parties and a number of influences, but that has to be done transparently. It can't be done behind closed doors in the way it has been. Sorry. But look, I don't have the answers, but I think we do need to have more debate on it, Jonathan. I think Kat's raised a very important point.
And I'm just mindful that Peter will be, Peter Wilson, who will be speaking here in 2 weeks' time, will be talking about institutional reform and specifically the idea of establishing a high-powered climate change committee of the kind that the United Kingdom was established in recent times. Brian questions, I think Rafe was next, and then there's about four or five other hands. So we can be reasonably quick, I'd appreciate it.
Thanks, Judy, for your great talk. Just focusing in on that institutional question, it seems to me you've got a comparative advantage in understanding how policy has been developed and frustrated. You know, we're now, you know, we've come through 20 years of incremental failure, you know, if I can put it like that. We're now facing an absolutely dramatic scientific, you know, well, a situation of crisis. You know, we need to get our emissions down very rapidly. How are our institutions going to, how are policy institutions going to grapple with that, you know, step change? If we can't even, you know, get them down to stabilisation, how are we going to cut them significantly without a massive step change, and what should that step change look like?
How long have we got, right? I think we need to get the fact on the table that we need a step change and an agreement. I think that's the first step, to understand that a step change is needed. I think we need to reflect very carefully about how we use our forestry, because we're still potentially using that by time while we find some big step changes. I think in the energy sector, we have the solutions. I mean, the solutions are all there staring us in the face. And however, they probably won't give us the step change that we need. It depends whether you're talking about CO2 intensity or whether you're talking about CO2 equivalent intensity across New Zealand. And I think there is a different debate to be had in both areas with respect to where that step change could be. You know, if we found some magic bullet in the agricultural sector, we could solve it overnight, probably. But I don't see that coming quickly.
But institutionally?
Institutionally? Well, I think we need to have more conversations on that, right? I think seriously, until there is an acknowledgement that this is a serious issue, I don't believe those institutional changes will occur. We're trying all sorts of things, and we've developed elegant policies with elegant ETSs, but now they are very inelegant, or not really ETSs even. So I can't answer that question, but I think that some of the answer has to be around giving a dialogue and an understanding of what the problem is first, the need for that big step change, and setting up a mechanism through an institutional arrangement that can actually have that conversation and look at where those big changes are. To support that, we must have the economic and social modelling, which is dynamic and looks out in the future. And that is urgent, because without that, we don't have the tools to be able to postulate the scenarios, to be able to do the analysis. So I think that if we could fill some of those gaps very quickly, and I think that we possibly have a good chance of doing some of that in the near future, we can then look at how the institutions can bring about those big step changes. But we need to be able to do the analysis.
All right, just have it
over
hand. So, just the lady up here, yes, please.
Sue Corton, thank you, Judy. I continual call for more dialogue, communication, public discussion. I'm curious in where you see the major tables or forum where the major polluters get to meet the public. Where are these discussions going to take place? Where should we be targeting these invitations to such discussions?
Well, I think we need to actually go and have some serious conversations with some of these people and actually sit down and put some of the facts on the table and try and work through with those people a way of getting their confidence for a start and getting an understanding of what the issues are. And I think those are conversations that independent groups can have, and to bring those forward into the political circle so that the politicians can see that the sector people are actually starting to shift. So I think that there are some very serious conversations that have to happen, and they have to be done on a personal level in the first instance, in my view.
I mean, could I just quickly comment that the Institute of Policy Studies has run a series of roundtables over 4 years now, which has involved some of the major emitters along with NGOs and so on. And I suppose one of the salutary aspects of that process is that though we've all sat there and had civil conversations, it probably hasn't changed views very much. And from my point of view, one of the sad things about the context in New Zealand is just how much the lack of leadership from the business community in this area, highlighted by a debate I had with the President of Federated Farmers a few weeks ago in a public forum, in which he said that unless 100% of the scientists agreed that it was a problem, he wasn't going to accept the science. And if you have the President of Federated Farmers saying that, I mean, you really do have a problem. Peter.
Julie has really done a very clear analysis. What crystallised in my mind, we actually have a parasite-host relationship.
Yeah.
But there are good and bad parasites, and if the parasites can be in conversation with the host, mm-hmm. then there's some possibility that the body will survive.
That's an interesting analogy, Peter, because while I was thinking about this talk, the life of ants and termites came to my mind. If we could understand how cooperation occurs in the biological world, whether there's something there that we could translate into what we do as human beings. So I think your analogy is very apt.
Right, so there's a question here.
Yes, I'd just like to address the matter of framing and languaging around this, and something that frustrates me intensely as someone who's been interested in this for a long time is the failure, even of our side, to use the language of risk management, which in fact is what it is, because when you start doing that, you actually blow the deniers out of the water, because only the very stupidest of them can say that there is 0.000% risk. All they're arguing over is the magnitude of risk, and I'm sure even farmers, for instance, take out insurance policies and fasten their seatbelts and that sort of thing, the ordinary risk management actions, and if they can't see the translation of that philosophy into the much bigger and more potentially catastrophic picture, well then that is perhaps an argument we can have, but certainly I would like to see the phrase and the techniques of risk management used a lot more in this debate.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because the adaptation work that's been done on climate change is all framed around risk management. And I've always had a view that if you can talk to the farmer about adaptation of his activities on the farm, that might actually get him back into talking about mitigation at the same time. Because I don't think they actually think of mitigation separately from adaptation when you talk to farmers, and I think that would be another way, through the back door, if you like, into the farming community to think about it.
Okay, probably time for just two more quick questions.
Framing the problem is absolutely vital. My members of the Domestic Energy Users Network are very quick to grasp at the straws that are coming in the media, with increasing frequency as Copenhagen approaches. It's these scientists who are lying to us. They will grasp at that straw, and that has quite strongly changed the opinion of my members, as I've called them up. They said, we don't have to worry. Now, I think the mischief-making by the media, and that's mainly the print media, but even radio and TV, has to be addressed directly. Otherwise, I'll say, they're just trying to do this for their own good. Those damn scientists.
Molly, it's all a left-wing conspiracy.
Well, for me, look how popular he is.
Final question. Yes, sir.
It's Peter Graham. I just wondered if you've seen the article in the paper this morning about the use of naive modelling, which compared the results of that with the complex modelling that's been done by IPCC and so on, and which seemed to produce a quite different result. A lot of people, they read that, and they think, oh, all this stuff about climate change is just nonsense. It's a simple approach which shows a negligible effect on the climate.
Yeah, no, I didn't have time to read the paper before, that was sort of pushing its home, so I haven't read that. But I think the point that you're making is partly the point Molly is making, is that there seems to be an attempt to try and counter the visible evidence of climate change and the modelling evidence, or the modelling that's been done by the IPCC. The IPCC is a peer review process with hundreds of thousands of scientists involved. And I think that what clinches it for most of us is that we're actually seeing the changes. We're not just relying on models. Models are now being validated by what's happening. But I couldn't comment on that particular article. But I think the temptation for the media to provide the so-called balance is actually quite destructive, because it is not a question of this model against the IPCC. If this model was okay, it would have been peer-reviewed through that process, and it may well be peer-reviewed through the next process. If it stands up, so be it. If it doesn't, well, that's that. So I just think we need to be very careful in what we read. But I think there is a problem because the public reads it.
Great. Quick point.
Yes. Anyone that wants to comment on that paper should look at the International Journal of Forecasting. That article was in a group and a whole set of articles which were concerned with risk management, not primarily with the climate change problem. And I think you need to look at that article in its context scientifically.
Thank you.
Quite misleading to get the impression that was given in the slides.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, look, could we start a question?